The Brewers broke a six-game losing streak in dramatic fashion yesterday, scoring four runs in the ninth. Milwaukee beat Seattle on the road 7-6. The Cubs, meanwhile, lost to the Rockies by a score of 11-4. The White Sox beat the A's 4-2. Now the forecast from the National Weather Service. Sunshine today, a high of 78, south winds up to 10 miles per hour. Clear skies tonight, a low of 58. Tomorrow, more sunshine, a little warmer if anything, a high of 82. More humid as well. The expanded forecast, showers and storms on Wednesday. Dry Thursday and Friday, temperatures around 80 for Wednesday and Thursday. A little cooler though for Friday. The normal high for this time of year is 78. The record for this date is 98, and that mark set in 1936. The sun will set this evening at 7:42. Right now, sunny skies throughout the area, 61 degrees in Kenosha, winds out of the west at 3 miles an hour. I'm David Cole, WGTD News. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is coming up.
Support for The Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe. Andreas, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. With the catastrophic flooding that is occurring in Louisiana right now, a lot of sad and even traumatic memories of Hurricane Katrina have come to mind. I've gone into the archives for two interviews which first aired 10 years ago, interviews recorded in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, one of them with Christopher Cooper, whose fascinating book is called Disaster, in which he explores not only the dimensions of the failure of FEMA to adequately respond to the crisis, but also explores some reasons why FEMA failed so miserably. Mr. Cooper, one of the things you talk about in your fascinating book is about FEMA and not only what all of us have heard about, that FEMA was a very much stripped back agency by the time Hurricane Katrina hit, but also the fact that it was hobbled in a sense by being a two-headed agency, as you put it. Tell us a little bit about that rift in FEMA and what impact that had on its response to Katrina.
Well, Greg, FEMA was invented by Jimmy Carter, and it worked for a time, and then under Reagan it worked less well, and under the first President Bush it worked even less well. I think people will remember Hurricane Andrew, people wandering around in the streets, not having food or shelter for days. So, you know, after 9/11, well, let me back up. Clinton brought FEMA up to a cabinet-level position where his man, James Lee Witt, could call him and say, I need 17 airplanes in Miami tomorrow, and those airplanes would arrive. After 9/11, FEMA was subsumed into this big, sprawling agency called the Department of Homeland Security, where it's one of the smallest agencies. And so now there are these layers of bureaucracy over FEMA, which hinders its ability to respond.
Well, and the fact that it is split, in a sense, as you said, even in almost personality, between the natural disaster folks and the national security folks, that they, at least at certain points, have seemed to really be at loggerheads with one another.
That's right. I mean, you know, I don't want to put too fine of a point on it, but, you know, terrorist events are for the big boys, and responding to disasters are for the girls. You know, let Brownie handle that. I mean, it's just a hurricane, right?
One of the most interesting things about your book is you help us understand why the people who acted in Katrina's wake, why they acted the way that they did. And in particular, one of the most interesting figures is this Matthew Broderick, not the actor, of course, but someone right in the thick of this disaster response. And you try to help us understand
why he was so hesitant to set certain wheels in motion. Explain to our listeners who Matthew Broderick was and this hesitancy which I'm talking about, which might have been appropriate on the battlefield, but not in this situation.
Matthew Broderick is the consummate military man. He's been involved in military events around the world, including, you know, Saigon and Mogadishu and places like that. He's interested in what he calls ground truth. In the fog of war, he needs to make sure that the information that he's getting and passing on to his superiors, like Chertoff and Bush, is absolutely accurate. What he fails to understand is that a disaster is a little different from a war. Sending troops blindly into a combat zone may result in lost lives. Sending extra food and water and helicopters into a disaster zone would likely do the opposite. And it just, you know, it never dawned on him that there were two, that these were different.
And so he ends up being focused on trying to round up small little details at the expense of the big picture.
That's right. He decides that, okay, the definition of mega disaster in New Orleans is going to be whether the levees fell down or whether water just came over the top of them. If water just came over the top, theoretically they could just be pumped back out and it wouldn't be a big disaster. So he spent 30 hours trying to determine whether the levee walls had fallen down and water was cascading into the city, or whether the levees had simply topped. And that's 30 hours. That put him 30 hours behind, and it took him a week to catch up.
You mentioned this fact of exactly when the levees were, in fact, breached, in fact, compromised, and you suggest a fair amount of evidence that in fact, this breaching of the levees may have begun to occur even before Katrina really hit.
The levees failed below their design rated strength. People think of Katrina as a massive storm, and it was, but Katrina hit Mississippi. Top sustained winds in New Orleans were roughly 85 to 100 miles an hour, which is a very small hurricane-level storm. The levees broke under a storm surge that was around 8 or 9 feet. These levees should have been able to handle 11 feet, but they fell down anyway. And these are not levees built by locals. They're levees that are built under the supervision of the federal government, and they collapsed.
In the wake of course, what was a terrible disaster, you talk about three very basic needs which New Orleans needed from FEMA, food and water, reliable communications, and buses for evacuation. You outline for us how FEMA was not able to provide any of those in any sort of meaningful fashion.
Well, FEMA didn't prepare very well for this. They knew what was going to happen. They had studied it. And even before the storm, people inside of FEMA who know what they're doing were saying, we don't have enough stuff pre-positioned in place. We have one day of food and water, and we have 50 generators when we should have 200 generators. After that, when they did realize how big it was, their guy who's asking for stuff is Michael Brown, who's a mid-level bureaucrat asking agencies like the Pentagon, can I have some airplanes to get some extra reinforcements here? The Pentagon's response is, you know, who are you? Why don't you get somebody with real authority to call us? Rumsfeld is in San Diego, so we can't help you.
In the wake of FEMA's widespread failure, you talk actually about how much of the rescue and recovery effort was actually maybe more effective than we realize. This incredible improvised effort on the ground, and much of that from regular citizens, it makes it kind of a strange story, doesn't it? I mean, failure on the one hand, a surprising amount of success achieved in spite of that.
It does, though. I'd qualify the success to some extent, and because there is no unified command, there's no single person in charge. Everybody's going out, dropping boats in the water, and going and rescue people. They bring these people back to dry land. They don't have any water or food to give them, and they go back out into the water. So the people on dry land who've been sitting on their roofs all day, and they're thirsty and they're hungry, begin to wander around the city looking for food and water. There's no FEMA food, and there's no FEMA water, so they start breaking into stores to get food and water. And that caused a big problem. I mean, at one point, there were 50,000 people wandering around the dry streets of New Orleans.
A last quick question. Among the many fascinating stories that are part of your book is the idea of loyalty trumping honesty. I think you're talking about that in reference to the importance of good information being shared by the people who most needed it. And somehow that did not happen, especially at the highest levels.
No, I mean, there's this fallacy that the federal government had no idea what was going on in the city of New Orleans, and that's just not the case. I mean, the information was stovepiped, and it was suppressed, and the people who really needed it, like the president and Mr. Chertoff, didn't get it in time.
And why would it have been suppressed?
Well, I mean, it goes back to Matthew Broderick. He decided that the most important thing was to provide 100% accurate information, and stuff that might not be completely accurate, he simply didn't pass on. And it's impossible to nail down every little detail of what's going on in New Orleans, even if you do know the big picture. And he certainly knew the big picture.
The book, again, is called Disaster, Hurricane Katrina, and the Failure of Homeland Security, published by Times Book, Henry and Holt. Christopher Cooper, one of the two authors. Christopher Cooper, I thank you for writing such a fascinating book.
Thanks a lot, Greg.
You're listening to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We've gone back into the archives 10 years to replay two really interesting interviews that concern themselves with a catastrophe that unfolded just over a decade ago in Louisiana and the Gulf Coast region, namely, of course, Hurricane Katrina. Here is part two of today's program from the archives.
It is, of course, the unhappiest of anniversaries that we observe with the one-year mark since the devastation of Hurricane Katrina. One of the most interesting articles which I have read in recent weeks about that disaster and its aftermath is an article which appears in American Journalism Review. This is a marvelous magazine which we receive here at the radio station, and actually over the last several months there have been a number of fascinating articles about the way in which the media has grappled to cover these disastrous events as they unfolded in both New Orleans and in Mississippi. And this most recent article is called The Ties That Bind, and it talks, among other things, about the relationship between local media in New Orleans and the citizens of that beleaguered city, and also the leadership of New Orleans itself as they grapple with all kinds of problems and issues. The author of this article is actually not from New Orleans, but from sort of the region, I guess you could say, Mark Licheron, who is a reporter for the Austin American Statesman, but someone who knows the city of New Orleans well and has written very compellingly about it in this article. Mark Licheron, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. I appreciate being on your show.
Well, I really have found your article to be especially interesting. Maybe you can tell our listeners a little bit about just how well, indeed, you know the city of New Orleans.
Well, this December will be my 30th anniversary of coming to New Orleans. I went on a family vacation when I was 20, a sophomore in college, fell in love with the city, and I've been coming back to New Orleans on and off ever since, so maybe two dozen times over the years, a couple of jazz and heritage festivals, three Mardi Gras, and endless dinners at Galatoire's and, on Bourbon Street.
Hmm. I've been there only once, as I think I mentioned to you when we talked earlier. I have to say that I am sort of haunted by the words of our cab driver who took us from the airport to the hotel downtown where we were staying for a convention I was attending. And I remember her explaining the system of levees and so on. And actually, we talked a bit about the possibility of what would happen if those levees failed. So this was a possibility certainly at the back of her mind and at the back of mind of many citizens. Can you tell us just how present and real that possibility was before Katrina?
Well, I think you have to understand the character of people who live in New Orleans. I believe that all of what you say the cab driver told you is true. How seriously people in New Orleans take that, I don't think has ever been realized until it actually happened. You live with it. It's I don't think it was ever a great worry, as I pointed out in this piece that I did for AJR. A couple of reporters for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, Mark Schlefstein was the lead reporter on it, pointed out 5 years ago that this whole system could have, in the event of this kind of hurricane, could wreak absolute havoc on the city. It was, the articles were prescient, they were award-winning, and I think they were largely ignored by most of the people in New Orleans who face hurricane season every single year.
Let's talk a bit about what has happened to New Orleans in the wake of Katrina and this terrible possibility becoming, in fact, a reality. First of all, this isn't really the focus of your article, but I'm sure you have a better awareness than many of us of the courageousness with which media in New Orleans were able to carry on, even through the very midst of this catastrophe. Just help us understand the valor and ingenuity which allowed the media to continue to function during Katrina to the extent that they did.
More than ingenuity, I would say resolve is the key word. I think people in the news media had determined early on whether they had a plan for evacuation or not. Radio stations, television stations, and of course the newspaper, the Times-Picayune, which was particularly courageous in that it lost its capability to print and yet continued to provide information via the internet. I think it was simply a determination on the part of small clusters of reporters and editors that they simply were going to maintain, and I use the term in my piece, a lifeline to the people in New Orleans. I think the internet proved itself, being an old newspaper man, I think we tend to scoff at the internet. This is just one more thing for us to worry about. But I think the internet proved itself absolutely the key to getting information to hundreds of thousands of people, both evacuees and people who wanted to get back into the city right afterward. Not only that, but you had people with the newspaper and the radio and TV stations who were committed to putting in ungodly hours and facing dangers that you and I would never face in our, I haven't faced it in 25 years in journalism. These are people who went in and witnessed looting and shooting and all manner of inhumanity, and simply because they wanted to keep the line of information available to whoever could get their information from the internet. And as soon as the print version of the Times-Picayune came back up, you had people just clamoring for that information.
It's so striking in your article when you talk about people looking at various news outlets and the newspaper in particular as a lifeline, because you say that is in such stark contrast to what is the reality in other places where a given newspaper might really be struggling mightily against the perception of being more and more irrelevant. I mean, here is exactly the opposite playing out in New Orleans.
Let me tell you, I've done pieces for AJR over the last 10 years or so, and sort of my subspecialty is looking at what makes newspapers in particular successful in some cities and not successful in others. And I can tell you that urgency, local urgency, is something that makes a newspaper successful. And that's an understanding that you have an obligation to give your readers the most immediate news that you can, and do it in a way that isn't simply going to night meetings to cover councils. It's telling stories about a community that become reflective of what the community is. I think that's what people really want in their news media. And here you have a recipe for this thrust upon the city of New Orleans. You've got news gatherers and newsmakers who are all bound up in this idea that we have to survive. And what's more compelling than this story, and what's more local than this story? Everything that comes into the city of New Orleans is now funneled through this thing we call Hurricane Katrina. Everything on the federal level, the state level, and the local level, all of it becomes absolutely imperative to the reader or to the viewer or to the listener. And I think that that's I'm hopeful if anybody reads this piece, if you're an editor or you're a reporter, what you ought to take away from this is not that you're going to have the same sort of urgent need or a disaster thrust upon you.
God forbid.
I'm sorry.
God forbid, I said.
Yeah, absolutely. But what you want is to, the lesson you want to take from that is, you know, we have compelling stories at the local level that we can tell and make a connection with our reader or our viewer or our listener.
Towards that end, one of the other things you talk about is a hunger that seems to be in the newspaper reading public and the television viewers of New Orleans, a need for, a desire for what you call at one point a new pugnaciousness, that is a courage, a lack of reluctance to ask really tough questions of those to whom the well-being of the city is entrusted. Tell us a little bit about the ways in which that pugnaciousness has played out.
In New Orleans, I think what you have, and if you know anything about the history of New Orleans and Louisiana in general, famous for the corruption and the sort of the acceptance of corruption in the political system. And when you have a breakdown, an absolute obliteration of everything organized in a community, you've severed all those ties. And that again, I think, this is a wonderful laboratory to see what happens when all of these systems of corruption are blown up. And in fact, before you called, I was looking at a piece in the New York Times. It's on the front page today. And what they were talking about are parents and activists taking over the school systems. And New Orleans was famous for its failing public school system. You've got three in the last spring elections. You had three of seven city council members, city council incumbents, defeated. That's unprecedented in the city of New Orleans. And then you've got this old-fashioned assessor's system. It was broken up into seven districts, and I believe I wrote a little bit about this in my piece. The assessor's system was broken up, and it was like seven little fiefdoms. And the House in this last election decided that they were going to roll all of these things into one district, and they're going to put it up to public vote. And I have no doubt in my mind that they are going to make a reform for that single district that they never would have had they not had Hurricane Katrina. So you've got a chance, and again, from a reporter's standpoint, you can stand back and say, oh my God, this is a whole series of reforms that we would never see in our lifetime had it not been for this hurricane.
Hmm. Well, I guess part of the point of your article, or this point in the article, is that this is also an opportunity for a lot of hard questions to be asked of the city leaders of New Orleans, whereas maybe once upon a time it was not always that simple a matter for a reporter to really do their job, in a sense.
And I'm glad you brought me back, because I was wandering a little bit, but to get back to that exact point, part of that acceptance of corruption, I think if you asked really honest people in New Orleans in the news business, they would tell you, you just sort of accept it because generation after generation it doesn't change. Well, now everything's changed, and I think there is a recognition, belated recognition, on the part of the newspaper and television stations that they have an obligation, not that this opens an opportunity, but they have an absolute obligation to those people who were stranded out there during the hurricane, that they have to act on the public's behalf to ask those tough questions, because New Orleans cannot afford to go back to what New Orleans was before Katrina. It's economically impossible. And that puts an extra burden, an extra responsibility, and an extra opportunity on the shoulders of the news gatherers to be really tough.
Hmm. And I am assuming that the typical talented, committed journalist, I mean, as much as they regret the awful circumstances of this situation, probably welcome the opportunity to do this kind of journalistic work versus the status quo before, in which the work of almost every journalist involves a certain amount of fluff or a certain amount of slick packaging. I mean, this is a different kind of journalism, a sort of pure journalism in many respects, which maybe a lot of journalists otherwise are not allowed to practice.
I think that's absolutely true, and many of the people I talked to when I was in New Orleans welcome this. And it is, as I said, a wonderful opportunity. But I will tell you that many of the best people in New Orleans are just very tired. There are people who are have still not taken a vacation. There are still people, and there in one case, and we can talk about that in a moment, of a photographer in New Orleans who had a breakdown. And I happened to write about him in my piece, and several weeks later, he's in the New York Times being written about, leading police on on this awful chase, simply because he had just gone off the deep end. He had been in therapy, and he had learned that he wasn't going to get the financing that he wanted to rebuild his home, and he lost it. And he's an extreme example. John McCusker, a wonderful photographer for the New Orleans Times-Picayune, is an exaggeration of what's gone on there. But the best people that I talk to at the paper and at the TV stations will tell you that this has been relentless for a year, and the pressure to produce first-rate journalism is very high because people are very tired, and they're wondering when they're going to get a break.
Right, and of course, most of these news outlets still operating, I think probably without exception, they are all operating with ranks that are, in your words, decimated. I mean, with skeleton forces in some cases.
Yeah, I believe in that. Jim Amos, the editor of the New Orleans Times-Picayune, was, I think, wanted to soft pedal that issue, and I don't blame him. He is in a precarious position. He wants to make sure that he is inspirational as a leader, and he wants to make sure that the people he is leading are not any more dispirited than they need to be. But when you're down 35 positions in a newsroom, and there are no promises that you're going to get those people back, you're going to be shouldering an extra load. And given the economics in New Orleans, I don't see TV stations or radio stations or newspapers piling on new staff, because they can't support it with viewership, or they can't support it with subscription, and so they are going to be making do with what they have now.
We're speaking with Mark Licheron, and we're talking about an article which he has written for the August-September issue of American Journalism Review, an article called The Ties That Bind, examining the local media's performance in the wake of Hurricane Katrina. One very interesting point you make in the article, which I would really love to have you explain a little further, is something that you call the dichotomy or even the schizophrenia which exists in the current situation in New Orleans. I mean, I think at the heart of it, you're kind of talking about kind of the good news, bad news scenario, but that certainly oversimplifies it, I suppose. But the idea that there are these promising sparks of growth and energy and yet all kinds of really discouraging signs as well. And you talk about how so much of that is wrapped up in the business of story selection in newspapers and in television stations and radio stations, for that matter, and how they go about covering life in New Orleans at this point in time. Tell us a little more about this dichotomy and how that is challenging journalists there.
Well, let me say at the outset that I think the core of optimism in the city of New Orleans is based on the fact that there is a conviction in New Orleans, and that I hope there's a conviction all across the country, that New Orleans as a cultural symbol is absolutely indispensable to the United States. New Orleans is the most exotic, most historical city in the United States. And the people in New Orleans are supreme believers in that indispensability. And when I spent time there, you did get people saying, I'm exhausted, you can't believe the horror I've been through. But you also, in those same people, got this absolute determination to stay there and to rebuild and not to be driven off by anything. And that kind of resourcefulness and that resolve is something that makes for absolutely compelling journalism. I've mentioned in my piece a fellow by the name of Chris Rose, who ended up winning a whole slew of awards for his columns. And basically what he did was he said, I'm going to write as a victim. And because he was, and he tapped into something so primal in New Orleans, this idea that you're on the edge of despair or euphoria, and sometimes in the same day. And I think that's the essence of what you see down there. There is this feeling that city can be rebuilt from the ground up, and it could end up being a better city. Maybe a smaller city, but maybe a better city. But by the same token, if you take a drive through, and I did this with the editor Jim Amos through Lakeview and Gentilly, two fairly well-to-do neighborhoods just south of Lake Pontchartrain, or right on Lake Pontchartrain, and so were just devastated by the breach of the levees. It's like visiting another planet. So much of it is devastated. So little of it has been rebuilt in a year that you say to yourself, my God, how could this ever come back? By the same token, you've got people who are sitting on that property and people who are speculating on that property because they believe that New Orleans will be back. And so do I.
You believe that because you really believe that, or do you believe that because you need to believe that?
A little of both. Yes, I need to believe that. I've been collecting New Orleans rhythm and blues records ever since I was about 12 years old. I have a huge collection of them. There's something about the music and the food and the culture that absolutely has entranced me for 40 years. Now, I do need that, but the journalist in me says the people in New Orleans want this, and they will make it happen. They will not let Katrina destroy them, and I think that's a hugely uplifting story. But yeah, there's so many things to overcome. No other city's been devastated in this way. I don't even believe San Francisco, after the earthquake in 06, had the same total devastation. I think that what you've got is this schizophrenia that I'm talking about. You have a huge will to succeed, tempered by so many obstacles, but I do believe that those people will overcome them. Hmm.
Can you give us some sense of what New Orleans is like right now in terms of how many of its citizens have returned and what portion of the city is, in a sense, alive as it once was?
Well, it's interesting, and after people started turning their attention after Katrina to other stories, I don't think people realized that many of the people in the suburbs, which is the middle class lifeblood of New Orleans, they all came back. Their houses were not destroyed. They came back and they started getting back into some sort of flow of life. The neighborhoods inside the city, including the Ninth Ward, which is predominantly African American, predominantly poor, the locus of many of the social problems in the city of New Orleans. I mean, those neighborhoods have been wiped out. I read something recently that suggested that the population estimate is somewhere around half of the 460,000 residents who lived in the city prior to Katrina. And I think the New York Times today said that would peg New Orleans' population at where it was in 1880.
Wow.
So you have a population that's basically been halved. I believe the racial makeup of the city is still pretty similar. I think that what you have, though, I think the people who are coming back have more resources. I don't believe the poor in any large number have come back because they just can't. They don't have the wherewithal, and there is no low-income housing for them to come back to. And so what you have is sort of like middle-class pioneers who are coming back, and in little pockets they're rebuilding houses, but it's at a certain amount of risk and a lot of the unknown.
I love it, the point in the article when you talk about these courageous people coming back. You say, for every 100 homes whose guts were pushed into the street by floodwater, there is one that has been reclaimed. We're talking about a certain part of the French Quarter. These residents are pioneers with no idea when or if they will again have neighbors. I mean, what an odd situation. And, of course, that's sort of like what the original pioneers settling our country faced as well. I mean, it was a real step of faith into the unknown.
Absolutely. And but you asked earlier about the resolve, about the what I thought the odds were that New Orleans would come back. When you drive through one of these neighborhoods and you stop in front of a home that has all of the National Guard markings on them, and there's a white truck out front, and there's a team of people in these white, what look like space suits, cleaning up toxic material, and surrounded by all of these other wrecked homes, and you see a contractor putting a house back together. I mean, you talk about taking a flyer and having faith. That's what you see there, and it's exciting because you can bet that those neighbors around that builder are not going to be back. They may not be back within 4 or 5 or maybe 10 years, but that one person wants to reclaim his or her home.
Well, and I suppose, I mean, maybe this is too grand an oversimplification, but in a sense, it really says something about sort of the mental frame of those who are coming back. I mean, it takes a certain amount of resolve to attempt such a thing. And so in many cases, the first people to come back and try to reclaim homes in these devastated neighborhoods are especially courageous people. And that, in a sense, sort of bodes well for what might happen.
Well, I think one of the best examples of this resolve is the speed with which parents and activist organizations, they're like loose confederations of people who wanted to get schools open, because there was this feeling that we can't even pretend to want to rebuild our community if our kids aren't going to school. And it's so interesting that the public school system has been a scourge in New Orleans for generations. And there is this tacit understanding on the part of these parents who have come back to say that we will not survive if we don't reform our school system and get those schools up and running. And they've done a wonderful job, but it's been fitful, it's been tough, but they've done something, and they've had to do it by circumventing the old order in the public school system in the city of New Orleans, which I think is just remarkable.
Let's return to the media for just a moment. I just have a couple more questions for you. You quote someone by the name of Dave Walker, who actually, I think, if I remember, he covers the media. Is that right?
Yeah, he covers the media for the Times-Picayune.
Yes. And in looking back over this event, I mean, he calls it, I think, a glorious time for those who cover the news. And he calls it, he said, suddenly you have an endless story and a bottomless news hole. That's a really interesting way to put it. I wonder if you would explain to us in what ways Katrina and New Orleans is an endless story.
Well, think about any traditional story that you can think of that goes into your newspaper every day. And then think about how someone in New Orleans gets that story delivered to them. If you recall in my opening of the piece, I talked about the murder rate disappearing in the city of New Orleans. And what happened was, obviously, the hurricane and its aftermath drives everyone out of New Orleans, including its criminal element. And so for weeks and months, you have no murder in one of America's murder capitals. And then all of a sudden, murder starts to climb as people start returning. Now, prior to Katrina, they had a gang problem, and they had a drug problem, and they had a murder problem. All of that was part of the fabric of the community. Now that story becomes a Katrina story. It's not murder, drugs, gangs. It's where are they going in relation, which neighborhoods are they infiltrating, who are they selling to, where did they come from, probably Houston. All of it filtered through Hurricane Katrina. Take your school issues. All of them are in some way touched by Katrina. All of the political reforms due to or as a result of Hurricane Katrina. It is a story, and when you talk to the reporters, they think it's a blessing and a curse. If you're 40 years old and a veteran reporter, chances are pretty good that you will be reporting on Katrina in one way or the other until you retire, if you stay in New Orleans. And some people see that as, well, this is the story that we have. But in another way to look at that is, oh, my God, I wish I could do something other than Katrina. but no, you're not going to do something other than Katrina, probably not in your lifetime. And I heard that over and over again from the reporters I talked to and the editors I talked to. This is, for better or for worse, this is what we're doing.
Mm. You know, I'm so glad you explained that as you did, because it corrects a misunderstanding that I had about the way this article opened. You You open your article, as you already told us, saying the banner story of the Father's Day edition of the New York Times-Picayune was a throwback. Five teenagers shot dead in Central City. And you go on to say that was really quite newsworthy in a way that it would not have been a year and a half ago, because that kind of spate of murders in New Orleans was very much business as usual. And then, as you say, murder vanished for a time from New Orleans. When I read that, I was thinking in a twisted sort of way that it reminded me of when life sort of returned to normal after 9/11. I still remember so vividly waking up the Thursday after 9/11, and instead of that wall-to-wall, endless, unbroken news coverage, I turned on the television at 7 in the morning, and there was a Burger King commercial on. And all of a sudden, it seemed like we're going to make it. Life is, in a sense, not back to normal, of course, for the poor folks of New York City, but at least for me in Racine, Wisconsin, life seemed a little more normal because this wasn't blanketing the airwaves morning, noon, and night. I sort of treated what you said at the opening of this article a little bit in that way, that in a sad, tragic sort of way, this was a signal of business as usual, but you correct that by saying that even business as usual is still has to be seen through the prism of Katrina.
Absolutely. At the end, and this is yet another challenge to the police department at New Orleans. What are you going to do to stem this? And if you are going to remake that city, do you simply concede certain neighborhoods to gangs and wholesale killing? I believe that there are discussions going on from things that I've read that would suggest that the police department is willing to try new things because they don't want to go back to business as usual. I'm not saying that they can. I'm not sure how successful they'll be, but they're, again, the commitment is we don't want to go back to the old days, and that's there again. All of these things are channeled through Katrina. I had an interesting chat with the restaurant critic at the Times-Picayune while I was there, asking which restaurants were open and which weren't. Well, they had just come out with a restaurant guide. In the past, the restaurant guide would have simply blocked out, a list of the top restaurants in what is, arguably the best restaurant city in the country. Instead, he said to me, I've become a business reporter, not a restaurant critic, because it's all about which New Orleans institutions can get their financing, which ones are open, which aren't open, what are the reasons why they're not open, and he said, it's opened a completely new avenue for me because I've been forced to look at the restaurant business in a completely different way, and all because of Katrina.
Wow. That's the kind of thing that those of us living such a distance away would probably never stop to think about, but the way in which every facet of that city's life is altered by what has happened there.
I also wanted to mention, I get the New York Times, and so I apologize for being a scum, but the New York Times has done, in my opinion, a wonderful job from the perspective of a reporter, a wonderful job of not giving up on that story. They obviously have the resources to do it, but I have seen just a wealth of personal stories and political, cultural news stories covered by the New York Times, and I've read from the top editorial decision making that they made a commitment to the city of New Orleans to report on that story, to remind all of us that this is still going on and that New Orleans should not be forgotten. And I think it says something about when the number one newspaper in the country says we need to keep this front and center, and not just because of an anniversary coming up, but but on an ongoing basis, and I think they've done a wonderful job, and I think they deserve applaudit.
Hmm. This fascinating article is, again, called The Ties That Bind. It's in the current issue of American Journalism Review and written by